Welcome to Covenant Presbyterian Church in West Des Moines, Iowa. This educational offering is part of our mission to bless our neighbors to the glory of God. We hope it blesses you.
Nathan, is this what COVID has done to us? Made us all a little squirrely?
Oh, I started
John
out that
saving
way.
Me with the segue there. That was great. Yeah, this is so. A couple of years ago, I resolved that I was going to start Contemporary Issues on time because we only had that little 45-minute window before worship, right? And so I said, I don't care who's there. I'm going to start something. And I, you know, a couple of times I had a video that was like queued up and I would just start it at 9 o'clock without telling anybody. But I have noticed in all of the different online meetings that I go to, they all start late. It takes us a long time to sort of get on and then actually get rolling. So
it's like settling down kindergartners, isn't it, Nathan?
It is a lot like settling down kindergartners. Yeah.
It can be done.
You know, the other thing that we have that, you know, and this is a COVID thing, is that when we actually see each other in real time, that's, you know, we just love that. We want to tell each other everything about our accordions and our magicians. But John's right. The topic for the evening is COVID. And where are we with COVID right now? First question, did anybody do your homework? Did anybody watch that? Excellent. Russ and Mary watched the PBS American Portrait documentary from back in May, which is forever ago, right?
And it's gotten worse since then.
It has gotten substantially worse since then, yeah.
Is Polk County, I haven't been watching the news, is it still going up or is it leveling off?
It is still going up steeply.
And the hospitals are afraid they're going to have to eliminate surgeries that aren't necessary.
Yeah, why they didn't do that 2 weeks ago, I don't understand.
Yeah. They should have.
Now, I want to do something. Deb, put up your right hand like this.
Deb? Oh, there you go.
Yeah, I turn it around so it's facing me, essentially.
Put your palm out on the other side.
High five. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So there are all kinds of cool Zoom box things that you can do. So funny thing about Zoom is that you are all in different spots on everybody's screen.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
So on John's screen, evidently John and Deb are right next to each other.
Yeah.
But on my screen, Deb's on top of John.
Yeah.
Deb's on top of Russ and Mary.
Yeah.
Isn't that crazy? I'm going to have to dive off because my bandwidth is going crazy. I'll be right back.
Okay. We'll try to let you in when you get back.
I don't know if you'll be back in the middle, though.
Here we are, back to music. He's in a band.
That's right. Yeah, so there's all kinds of fun things you can do on Zoom. You can give everybody a high five, but everybody has to do it together. All sorts of interesting things you can do, but they have to be independent of where you're located on the screen. There is apparently Zoom magic that I can decide where I want you all to be, but I only learned that 2 days ago.
That's a controlling thing. You would never do that anyway.
No, not at all. So COVID has, among other things, made us really hungry for time with each other. And so I don't begrudge us the need to start class 15 or 20 minutes late, as long as we're having, you know, good, fun conversations with each other. Because we've been at this a long time, like long enough that there was a documentary about what COVID is doing socially to us back in May, right? You know, and it's like looking at baby pictures, right? It's like, oh, look at those people. Like, they thought it would be over at some point. Weren't they so cute to think that? So COVID has been sort of in the human world for 11 or 12 months, kind of. It was sort of, it began really spreading in China at the end of 2019. And I didn't research to double check my months, but we are round about the first anniversary of COVID having jumped from some kind of wildlife into human. I think there were bats originally, and then it jumped through a pangolin into a human, something to that effect. So, and it arrived in the United States, the first cases in something like January-ish. At the beginning of March, it was declared a global pandemic. So it had, to be a pandemic, it has to be spreading uncontrollably on multiple continents. I'm gonna give the really quick summary of sort of the science of COVID as we understand it, not like the sort of the virus and how does it get into your cells. That's actually related to the name coronavirus. It's how the virus is shaped. That's all the image I'll give you. You've all seen the image everywhere, but that's so that it can get into your cells better. What we know about it, I wish this went without saying, but we know this, it is more deadly than the flu. It is more deadly than the flu. We are getting better at reducing the severity of sort of the average COVID infection. We still don't know about long-term effects of the infection, even if you kick it. Kick the infection, not kick it. That happens as well. COVID is generally thought of kind of primarily as a respiratory transmission route. It's not exclusively a respiratory infection. So there are some really significant vascular issues related to COVID. There are even apparently neurological issues related to COVID. So it can present in different forms because it can go different places in the body. Part of what that means, and this is significant for where we are and the fact that we are all still on Zoom, is that there are a lot of different symptom profiles. So if you have the flu, you kind of know you have the flu, right? It kind of looks like one thing. And the thing we call the stomach flu is not the flu, it's norovirus. But if you have influenza, that's what it is. It has one set of symptoms and they're everywhere and you feel miserable for a week and then you generally speaking get better. Coronavirus, COVID-19 has a lot of different symptom profiles, some of which vary by age of patient and a lot of which vary by whatever reason they vary. Part of what that means is that we don't necessarily know who has it in time. We don't necessarily know who has it until after they've been contagious. Some of that is because people can have symptoms that they didn't connect or relatively mild symptoms that they didn't think were as bad as it is. This novel coronavirus also has a stealth mechanism that it uses where you are contagious for 2 or 3 days before you are showing symptoms. I'm going to say that again because it is why we are here. You are contagious for 2 or 3 days before you show symptoms. There's also a delay in figuring out who has it just because testing takes a while, right? The most accurate tests take 24 to 48 hours after they stick the Q-tip up your nose so that you can find out whether you've got it. Those are the most precise tests. The more rapid tests are, generally speaking, less reliable. They're much, much faster. That's a trade-off you almost always have, right? You can do your work quickly or you can do your work well.
Quantity versus quality.
Yes. So there is also a sensitivity curve. So after you're infected, the level of virus that you're shedding is down here. And it slowly builds and slowly builds and slowly builds. And round about here is when your test is sensitive enough to pick up your infection. Round about here is where you start shedding virus to other people. And then round about here is when you actually start to feel sick. And whatever the disease process that we think of didn't start until all the way over there. And so you've been contagious for a little while. And before that, there was a time when you could get a test and it would have a false negative simply because you took the test too soon. Because you didn't know that you were exposed to somebody, or you thought you might have been exposed to somebody, so you took the test the next day and it didn't necessarily show what would eventually develop. That's just us against the biology. There's not a lot we can do to fix the one where you just don't know you're sick yet. We can respond to the knowledge that we don't know we're sick yet. And that's part of why, again, we are still online. So we don't know, you don't necessarily know you have it. You don't know you've been shedding it until you start showing, or you have been shedding it before you started showing symptoms. The other piece of the situation that we are in, and we are solidly in that situation in the state of Iowa, the sort of standard pandemic management tools that public health uses are testing and contact tracing. So we went through a few of the drawbacks of few of the things we have to know about testing in order to manage the data correctly. Contact tracing is when we get John's positive COVID test back, then we public health as an institution, run and tell everybody that John has had direct contact with that they may have been exposed. You can only do that up to a certain scale. And at this point in Iowa, we have way more active cases than public health is able to contact trace. So the public health experts look at numbers like we have in Iowa right now and say the first thing you've got to do is get those numbers down, and then we can start to control the spread of this. Okay, so that was more bad news than I really wanted to present just then. Because there are things we can do. Testing and contact tracing so that you can then quarantine people who have it or have been exposed. That's how you actually tamp it down, right? You tamp it down by making sure it can't get from me to you, or from me to anybody else, not just you. The other go-to thing that we have been using, and we have found this to be generally useful, is wearing simple fabric masks and keeping our distance from each other. Bev is saying 3-ply. So you need...
Well, they sell 2-ply. So what are you supposed to do?
They also sell 3. You just have to look for it. In fact, the prices are coming down on the blue paper ones that you can get off of Amazon.
Well, I have a cloth one I got at Target, but it's a 2-ply. Right.
But it has pockets on either side.
Pockets.
You can put a third layer in there. They say coffee filter, which is kind of a little stiff, but another ply of some kind. The third ply, excuse me, is important. It's very
amazing. Go ahead, Bev. I'm sorry. I talked over you.
That's okay. I was finished. That's okay.
All right.
Interestingly, bizarrely, I had an actual professional briefing on this stuff this afternoon on another Zoom meeting, because it was for my college 50th reunion. And one of the people on the committee is an ER doctor who knows all of this stuff. Sure. So we were trying to figure out whether we could still have a 50th reunion. He walked us through this. Many interesting facts, but the one was the way that the pros figure it, three ply for them in the ER, in his hospital, consists of an N95 mask, which only has one ply typically, but then the second ply is going to be an ordinary cheap surgical mask, and the third one is going to be a face guard. He said that's three ply. Anything else is not as good.
Got it. But
so now I learned something.
They do sell the masks. If they don't sell, if they do not state three ply, meaning three layers of fabric for the common Joe, and especially if you're with someone for more than 15 minutes, if you're walking by them, your chances are fairly slim. But if you're somewhere and visiting 6 feet apart even, the third ply does make a difference, and it'll say it on the box. It won't even say how many ply if it's not three ply. Right, Nathan, are you finding that as well?
So I have fabric masks that I haven't actually worn a paper mask at all during the pandemic because I have an in-house seamstress, and she made fabric masks for us right away.
Nice.
And so I haven't had to do any mask shopping. So I
got it.
Which means I wasn't even at the level of knowledge that you're bringing here with two ply versus three ply in the paper mask world.
They're on Amazon, and they've come down about 30% to 40% in price.
Yeah, and something we have found as the pandemic time has gone on, a lot of the things that we were afraid of being short of early in the pandemic, including masks, a lot of those shortages have been made up in terms of the supply chain. Infamously, there was a time at the very beginning back in March when I believe it was the World Health Organization, in fact, was saying, don't wear a mask everywhere you go. And what they were trying to say about that was, don't go buy every N95 mask there is, because doctors need those and paramedics need those. And so they were, it was an unfortunate sort of imbalance in the information that people had, because it has been taken as masks don't work. And what they knew was they didn't know how well masks worked. They also knew that if everybody bought masks and sucked up the supply of masks, then there wouldn't be PPE, the personal protective equipment, for the people who really desperately needed the high-end masks. We have since found that basic homemade or off-the-shelf masks work. They don't work as well as an N95 mask, but you are not a surgeon. I'm double checking to make sure none of you are surgeons. Warren plays one on TV.
It's my secret life. You'll never know.
So in your average everyday going about life, you don't need an N95 mask. So long as you are also managing the situations you put yourself in, right? Mm-hmm. Because what we have found is that masks Having a mask, even not an especially good one, means that the stuff that comes out of my mouth, instead of going this far, it goes this far. And so that makes you safer at some distance from me. But that 15-minute thing also matters, because the longer we spend with each other, the more of those little aerosols we let out into the room.
Yeah.
And your masks don't necessarily fix those. And if the heat is on, which many of your venues in the world already have their heat turned on, even though it's been pretty warm the last several days. If the heat is on and the humidity goes down, then those little evaporate or aerosol pieces stick around in the air even longer. So rather than
drying up, they stay around longer. It doesn't help dry them more.
Well, it's like a little mummifying thing, but then all they have to do is land somewhere they get wet again, and that mummies don't do that part, but but viruses do.
Yeah.
we're finding that there is more, they've been careful how to say this, there's more longer distance droplet transmission than we originally thought. They're careful not to say airborne transmission, because the word airborne triggers a whole different set of precaution types at the hospital. And hospitals are not the primary place people are getting COVID. And so hospitals are actually doing pretty well at the infection control of this. Poorly ventilated venues where you get a whole bunch of people together, like to nominate a Supreme Court justice, it can pass all around those areas without the kind of close contact that you would otherwise need. So the close contact definition is closer than 6 feet for longer than 15 minutes. But if you're in the same air for much longer than 15 minutes, it doesn't matter if you're closer than 6 feet. Also, speaking, singing, shouting, dental procedures, certain other medical procedures increase the aerosolization. And so that's why your surgeon and your dentist need N95 masks, and you shouldn't use them all.
And they do, my dentist does.
Yeah.
Very much protected from me.
Yeah. So I bet you are wondering, when does this end, right? That's what you've been really hoping for? Is that I'll tell you just precisely, without any ambiguity, when this all ends. So I'm going to show you this little video.
Is that the continents moving back together? It's not going to be that long, is it?
Yeah, no, those continents are basically just where they were. So this is North America.
Yeah.
And yeah, you can see that this is not a class on plate tectonics, but look at how both sides of the Atlantic kind of fit together.
Yeah.
Isn't that cool? And so the Pacific, that's right. The Pacific is actually getting smaller. How cool is that? That's India, right, where it smashed up into Asia and made the Himalaya Mountains.
It made them tall, yes.
That's right. Yeah, you've got Africa splitting apart right here down the Great Rift Valley.
Wow.
Isn't that fun?
Is Australia,
what's Australia's deal? Yes, Australia does have COVID.
Okay.
I don't know that there's any country in the world that doesn't have a significant amount of COVID now.
I think we all do, yeah.
Australia's
had some 0 days though, where they haven't had any new cases recently.
Yeah, so Australia, New Zealand had a good chunk of time that they were at zero cases as well. They've got some again.
Okay.
China actually has it relatively under control. Last I checked, but I haven't checked on China recently. Europe, of course, got hit very hard, got it pretty well under control. It is coming back in Europe. Similarly in Washington and New York. So the places in the, even within the United States, of course, we've had a very uneven uneven progress here. And so it hit Washington hard, and then it hit New York and hit the cities of kind of the Northeast very hard. And once it kind of once it was more or less under control there is when it started to really blossom in the Midwest. And there are all kinds of reasons probably behind that. There was one point this summer that somebody looked at the COVID map and said, I can tell where the high temperatures are, because it was all through the South. And remember the thing I said about poor ventilation and dry air? Everybody worked hard in the South to make dry air for a while, didn't they? And so there was a big surge there. That was actually around the time it started surging in Iowa. We've talked about these waves that it sort of has gone, you know, sort of up and down. But at this point, the recent spike in Iowa is so tall, you can't see the previous bumps.
Oh, sugar.
So we are still on the first wave. It was a little slow coming, and now it's here. I kept hoping those were the big spikes.
Yeah.
And they were.
Wow.
So this is a little short animation talking about when is a pandemic over? How do we get from the beginning of a pandemic to over? And how can we tell when that is? So I'm going to share this with you. I'm going to double check and make sure I've got the words on. I do have the words on. So I'm going to share this with you, and then we'll jump back and talk about, okay, how do we get from where we are to over?
Yeah.
Wasn't that just super hopeful and uplifting at the end?
Yes, that was. Just have to hang in there.
That was the intent. What do we do about the fact that that is left-wing propaganda
manifestly not happening?
Say that again.
What do we do about the fact that that is manifestly not happening? And John mentioned the way that knowledge about the pandemic has been deeply politicized, at least in the United States. And we have to come back to that. I know that's not always our favorite place to go. So we need to come back to that. Again, the sort of the three options. One is just let it go through the population. Take who it'll take. The rest of us will have immunity to it. Not the preferable situation.
Right.
Not necessarily so different from the situation we are presently in Iowa, right? We're only
at 15% though, Nathan. I mean, at this point, right?
Right. So that's
not deaths, that is cases.
Yeah, and I'd have to, one moment while I double check how many actual total cases we've had. So 15%, if you're talking about the positivity rate that they keep citing, so that is how many of 100 tests that are administered in a given 14-day period, 15 of those came back positive. The epidemiologists say that if you are getting a positivity rate greater than about 3 to 5%, you are not testing enough. because again, the idea,
the people wanting them.
We might need to talk about why there has not been enough testing in Iowa, because it has not always been a test supply problem, although it is right now. Simply because there are so many cases that all of a sudden we are burning through our tests.
But they were also closing down testing zones, testing facilities.
Yeah, and those have been sort of picked up and moved around and rearranged on some kind of regular-ish basis that I assume is up to the National Guard.
Okay. I think it's up to the governor.
Yeah, so, okay, so there have been a total of 157,911 individuals who have tested positive in Iowa since the beginning of the pandemic. The first positive test was March 8th.
Okay.
So that, and they're saying that's about 1 in 20. So we are at about 5% of the Iowa population has gotten COVID-19 and known it. And known it. Obviously not all of those people, or not all of Iowa has been tested. About a third of Iowa has been tested. So we're over 1 million tests administered. Again, not all in the last 14 days. In the last 14 days, 20.2% of the tests that have been administered have been positive.
Nathan, what was the percentage you said of people in Iowa who have actually gotten the disease and noted?
Just under 158,000.
Okay, I thought you said something about 1%. I must have misunderstood, because that would not be right.
Okay. No, that's 5%.
Okay.
So the epidemiologists say you need a test positivity rate of 3 to 5% in order to feel confident that you're getting effectively all the cases. You're not going to get all the cases, right? But to have a sense that you're getting basically all of these. A 20% test positivity over the last 14 days tells us that we at least need 4 times as many tests just to get a handle on the size of the current outbreak.
Are people supposed to go get a test even if they've shown they haven't been around anyone that has had it? I mean, or supposedly had it.
I can comment to that.
Yeah, go ahead, Warren.
You have got to go through a gatekeeper. I have just done it a couple days ago to get the paperwork to allow you, if you can find a testing center that has an open date, to even go. Now, I've been tested about 2 months ago, probably. And they sent me some kind of follow-up. So just within the last couple of days, I said, well, yeah, I'll go and just check again. I was not issued that permit to go to one of these testing centers. And there's only 2 in Polk County. One out by Firestone and one down on Euclid by the river. And I think they were shutting the one on Euclid down.
In Merle Hay, behind Sears. They've got a testing site set up.
Well, on the web page I looked at, it listed 2 in Polk County. So it's good to know that there is one over by Sears. So I was interested in a test, would have signed up for a test, but they says, we have no dates available for you. Well,
right.
What do I do, I guess? I'm not going to go and pay $80 for a test, which I guess you can do at a clinic. But that's the ritual. And you always see on the interstate, you know, there's directions to these testing centers. by appointment only, and boy, they
That's
don't.
Right.
They don't change. So I was.
Well, I've had no symptoms. I mean, I've had. I guess I've had no reason to be tested. I assume that I'm okay. But
right,
you know.
And right. And odds are, if you know whom you've been in contact with, odds are you don't need to be tested. So long as you know who any of your contacts have also been in contact with. So remember that your bubble is only as safe as the least careful person in your bubble. But
I note that the powers that be who don't want us to know this stuff continue to tell us that you can get tested if you feel like it. And that is just flat wrong.
You have.
Now, I have previously gotten tested effectively because I felt like it. I've had two tests, both as out of what I would certainly describe as an abundance of caution, because I had been in a setting with a large enough number of people, and I wasn't confident that I should just continue on without knowing. And so I went ahead and got tested. It was negative each time. But I did that at a time when there was plenty of testing materials and there were plenty of time slots, which is to say, my most recent one was probably 5 weeks ago. And I haven't, you know, I haven't needed, I haven't had cause to think I would need one since then. And in the meantime, those numbers have gone through the roof. And we are now having shortages of testing materials again, similar to what we had very early in the pandemic. Early in the pandemic, there was a time that I thought I probably should get tested, and there were no convenient time slots, I think, within the next several days. And I thought by the time I could get tested, I'll know, because I'll know whether I have symptoms, which not everybody has symptoms. We weren't as clear about that at the time. But we seem to be back to the kind of testing shortages that we had previously.
I found when signing up at that Test Iowa website, I couldn't get in until like a Friday or Saturday. I went on and Monday was open. I mean, it just, they start it once they finish up the week, then they don't push forward 2 or 3 weeks with it. It's just pretty much the last couple of days of that week prior to that the schedules seem more open.
So my neighbors all have it and they called the 211 number.
Mm-hmm.
And they were sent to a Unity Point or a Mercy, I'm not sure which one now, Mercy or Unity Point, one of the clinics in the East Village. And they're trying, if you know somebody's positive and you're getting tested because someone in your family is positive, then they're trying to send you not to your doctor, but to one clinic where all the COVID patients are being sent to try to keep exposure down that way.
Iowa Clinic is doing that as well. I called my doctor a few weeks ago, was afraid I had caught it. Turned out to be a common cold, but they said, we've not had a COVID person in our office, Iowa Clinic, in my physician's office since, you know, March. They closed the doors on that. And so that means Iowa Clinic, Unity Point, Mercy, whoever, they will send you, and it is the smoothest. You go online, you type in, you get your appointment within the hour, and you take off once they contact you 15 minutes before the appointment, and you head to the clinic to get tested. And you may not walk in the building on your own. You wait until you let them know with your phone that you've arrived. Then they tell you, okay, now it's your turn. You might wait 5 or 10 minutes, but I mean, it's
awesome. I'm glad for that. And I'm glad to know that at least the, so far the clinics are able to still have some capacity. Test Iowa, the state administered tests, as Warren described, they are at and above their capacity. Be advised to put this in your, seriously, put this in your personal decision-making basket for the coming foreseeable future. The hospitals are filling up. We are at about 30% of inpatient beds available in the sort of the south central region, which is how the state has been tracking hospital beds. So the region kind of where all the serious cases come to Des Moines, we're at about 30% of our available inpatient beds, which is, that'll make any hospital administrator lose sleep. And
I know three teachers and again,
the curve is not bending yet. Go ahead, Deb.
I know three teachers who have students, high schoolers, that have the immunopressed, I'm not gonna not get the name right, the after effects of COVID, where the livers are failing and the kidneys are failing and their hearts are swelling, and that are at, all three are at Blank, but they're not all three from Polk. Two of them were from outer, more rural areas in Iowa.
Right, and so they'll show up in the hospital numbers, but their case numbers show up elsewhere, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So that is not a huge problem, but it is definitely a problem.
Yeah.
And is that a terminal thing?
No, they don't know yet.
Yeah, it's very hard to tell exactly what the long-term effects of something that only jumped into humans a year ago really are going to be. It looks like there are after effects of the sort that are likely to stick around, based on the kinds of damage it does in bodies. So even if you are young and healthy and think you would pull through this fine, still don't get it, please.
A lot of high school athletes are getting the thing with the heart.
Yeah.
They've had COVID, where their heart is swelling and there's fluid on the heart and the two parts of the heart aren't coordinating together. So they're not beating right. Mm-hmm. And they're getting it worked out and they're being followed and they're able to still work out and be athletic, but it's very cautious. And they do seem to be knowing what to do for those kids. Mm-hmm. But those numbers are getting higher in the US as they start to know more about the illness, that they're seeing a lot of athletic teenagers.
So
and I know Valley canceled its game on Friday.
Right, because of cases in the football program. Yeah.
So many. So, and there's on virtual because numbers are high.
So here's a question that is basically rhetorical. We know so much about how severe this virus is and how severe the consequences of this infection are. Why aren't individuals making better choices about the settings they put themselves in?
I believe that this has serious implications for Christian faith. That's the answer to your question. My reasoning is this. We have a duty to care for ourselves and each other and the world. And many, many people are making an article of their faith in humanity. Not humanity isn't the right word. Their faith in themselves, that they don't have to pay attention to this stuff. And that's, I think, what you're alluding to. But I have noted that I thought there were probably about a third of the country that would vote for anything that our present government puts forth. I have now discovered that only by a thin majority do we have people who won't go out and risk themselves and everybody else because the president or whoever the powers that be say so. That gives me very serious questions in Christian ethics. I don't have the answers, but I do not right now have the faith that I did have that most of the world is good, because I just got a demonstration by a score of 50-46 that it isn't. And that may be strong, but that's my answer to your question.
So,
but a lot of those people that voted the way they did.
So let me.
Our governor says that because they voted that way, she knows she's doing the right thing, and that doesn't make any sense. Those two don't correspond.
So,
but there are leaders that are telling them that they're safe in doing that. So some of it moves away from faith or Christianity and back to, and not good or bad, but the fact that they have leaders they're putting their trust in.
The politics.
Leaders are saying God is going to protect you. So it's a weird, I don't know.
Yeah. So the I was really hoping that the first answer would be that people are just bad at making good decisions, because people are bad at making good decisions. And there's a, you know, a whole field of psychology specifically looking at why do people make such such sort of counter evidence decisions. I'm going to come back to politics. Don't worry, it's there.
We have
to mention that. You also mentioned that we know how bad this is, and we know what to do. You know, why are we not doing it? I think it's because there are far too many people that don't believe the truth.
Like I said, I'm going to come back to politics, and I'm going to come back to politics on both sides. So hang on for that. But yeah, Warren.
I'll give a quick answer. None of us were around in 1917 or 1919, and none of us truly appreciate how severe this COVID-19 is. So I just call it ignorance, maybe for lack of a better reason. There's just, we don't have anything to compare this with in our lifetime as adults. And so that's why we're, you know, just kind of unwilling to do all these unpleasant things.
But Warren, we weren't there in that age, in that time period. But why are we so smart? That we're staying safe.
That's what Warren's saying.
I'm saying we have nothing in our life that has been this severe in terms of global.
But why are we smart and others are so seem so stupid?
Why is this particular contemporary issues class so smart?
Why are we smart and other groups aren't?
You, not we. Don't include me. I'm not saying I'm smart.
No, but you haven't. Got the COVID. You've been safe. You've been staying at home. You're smart.
So there's always going to be exceptions to any to any sort of statistical distribution, right? So I think part of what Warren's saying is just right on the money, that we don't have an intuitive sense of what a pandemic is like. Right now, you know. However many months in we are, we have a much better intuitive sense of what a pandemic is like, right? But as Warren says, we don't have sort of a visceral history with this, which is supported by this this psychological understanding that people are bad at making difficult safety choices, right?
Yeah, but when you look at all these people that are getting, you know, really sick and have all these after effects that don't go away, you'd think that would scare more people to doing the right thing.
And you would think that the knowledge of how bad tobacco smoking is for you, which we have known for a long time, right?
Yeah.
Would have made some of your choices very different
for
possibly a long time, right?
So do you have an answer to this question?
So I have a little bit of an answer. Part of the answer really is that we are bad at making sacrifices for safety that is not presently in front of us, right? And when you consider that we had to be dragged kicking and screaming into having seatbelts installed in our cars, you know, as a populace, and, you know, just to continue that metaphor, how many of us just in the last week have made driving decisions that we honestly ought not to have made, but we got away with them, right? You know, we we took an exit too late, or we, you know, we sped up to get around somebody we should have just stuck in behind because it didn't even save us that much time, or you know, we looked down to try to figure out who was texting us. Of course, we weren't going to text them back, but while we're driving. So why do we make such poor safety decisions? And I think part of it is that we get away with it so often. And some of that has to do with not having the visceral experience of a pandemic. So we don't have as really solid a sense of how do we navigate this safely. Now, I do also have to come back to the reality of the way that the United States has responded to the pandemic. And I'm going to cite here research done by Jonathan Rothwell and Christos Makridis, who are both political scientists. I don't think they agree with each other's politics, and I'm sure not one of us in the room agrees with each of their politics completely. So they're going to look at this from a political science standpoint. And they found, this was published in September, they found that state-level political partisanship explains the public health policies that have been adopted in response to COVID-19. State-level political partisanship. So which party dominates a state's political machinery, and how strongly does that party dominate the political machinery, has a huge effect on how the public health policies in a given state played out. Both sides get this wrong. Both major parties get this wrong in distinctive ways. So they found, this was early on, Bev wants to get in. Go ahead, Bev.
I wanted to ask you though, the thing is, the people who are there making the medical decisions are appointed people by the governing side, you know? I mean, so if it's mostly a Republican area, you're going to have people that they know, that they appreciate, that they're in their back pocket, and they're going to be the ones making the political decisions. So, yeah.
Point of clarification.
Yes.
Dr. Fauci is a civil servant and was not selected to be in this position by any politician, and therefore he cannot be fired unless there's something that he demonstrated poor judgment or malpractice.
I am firing Dr. Fauci, but here in Iowa, I feel it's different. In the state governments, isn't that different, Warren, than I am
such a... I think it depends on, probably depends on the state. So for instance, the state epidemiologist, what's her name, Dr. Pedotti, right?
Yeah.
I don't know whether she is a appointed by the governor or whether she is, it seems that she came up through the ranks within the Department of Public Health, but I don't know for sure whether she's directly appointed by the governor into that role. But we're talking here at the intersection between medical expertise and politics. And so you're right, there's a piece of, there's a piece of the Department of Health may or may not be in charge of every aspect of the public health response, right? Mm-hmm. So you have, for instance, within the Iowa decision-making process, there is the governor's office. The governor's office is receiving input from the Department of Public Health, both career civil servants who are compiling all the statistics and managing individual pieces of how the policies get put together and so forth, and a political layer of that. The governor also has weekly input from the White House which doesn't agree with itself, because the governor gets weekly input from the task force that's jointly under the CDC and the White House, chaired by Dr. Birx, which I go back to frequently because it's got such common sense responses that we should be taking, and the governor of Iowa routinely refuses to take those steps.
Right.
Now, I would think she was wrong whether I agreed or disagreed with her on any other political stance, because I have from the beginning of this tried to look at, I've tried to look away from political appointees to, as Warren said, Dr. Fauci, who has been, you know, this is not his first pandemic. He's been right. in the Federal Infectious Disease Agency since AIDS, you know, which is still around, but it's well managed these days, right? At the same time, Rothwell and Macredis found a specific sort of statistically verifiable differences between the ways that Republican jurisdictions and Democratic jurisdictions approached the public policy here. They found this piece is almost anecdotal, except that they were able to actually find some statistical response because the numbers were big enough. But just as a for instance, this is on the Fox News side. So you know who Sean Hannity and Tucker Carlson are. Each of them Fox News commentators, they each have their own show, right?
Who was the second guy besides Sean?
Tucker Carlson.
And he's on?
He's also on Fox News.
Oh, all right.
Which makes Along for with a Rush really- Limbaugh. Rush Limbaugh is on radio.
All three are similar though.
So listen to this though, because what we end up with here is what economists like to call natural experiments. So you've got Hannity and Carlson. This was early in the pandemic. Hannity downplayed the severity of COVID-19. Tucker Carlson took a stronger response to COVID-19, said this is serious, we've got to take it seriously. Sean Hannity's viewers took precautions later than Tucker Carlson's viewers. They were slower to begin social distancing and staying at home and wearing masks and so on and so forth. They found that at a county level, you could find the television ratings at a county level. At a county level, the ratings of Sean Hannity's show predicted the number of infections in the county. So the more people in your county watched Sean Hannity, the more infections you had. And so this is an interesting natural experiment, right? Because you can't say, oh, you know, there's a demographic difference between, you know, Fox News viewers and MSNBC viewers, or, you know, you get rid of a whole bunch of confounding factors because you've got two hosts on the same channel. So a lot of the audience is going to be very similar, but they've selected two very similar but distinct in this case sources of information. It is certainly true that the more politically conservative someone is, the more likely they have been to downplay the severity of COVID-19 and to downplay the or to choose a lower level of sort of governmental and society-wide response, right? They also have found that the other side, not that both sides are necessarily wrong, so we should throw them all out and pox on both their houses necessarily, right? Also finding that the more politically liberal someone is, the more they tend to downplay or discount the other effects of closing all non-essential businesses, locking everybody inside, not having anything go on. The more politically liberal someone is, the more likely they are to underestimate or discount the negative effects of social distancing, stay at home orders and the like. And there are manifest negative effects.
That's infringing on their freedom though.
No, this is, Democrats are likely to downplay the negative effects. So what are some negative effects of social distancing?
Okay.
What are some negative effects of the idea that you can just shut things down until the virus goes away? Right. What are some actual negative effects of that? Can you think of any?
I don't get a good meal out.
Yeah, you can't go to restaurants.
Unemployment.
Unemployment.
Yeah.
So people who can't work remotely lose jobs, or at least they lose income.
The lower end.
So these effects fall heaviest on the most vulnerable. That's almost always the case in almost everything, right?
In history.
Yeah. What are some other negative, what are some other costs of a, you know, let's speak in extremes, because this is part of what Rothwell and Macready's found, was that the more polarized we are, the more extreme our choices tend to be. So we had the extreme choice. Sorry, this is my right. I don't know if it's your right. The extreme choice of don't do anything. It'll be fine. It's not even that big a deal. Right. That's over on the political right. You've got the other extreme choice of lock everything down until it goes away. That's on the political left. Again, these are caricatures maybe, but what are some costs of lock everything down until it goes away? We've identified economic depression as one of them. What are some other costs?
Rental.
Say that again?
Mental, emotional depression.
Mental and emotional depression. It is hard to be locked up, right? This is why prison is a punishment. It is hard to be locked up.
Well, and kids who are doing their schoolwork remotely, some of them have the discipline to stick with it and do a good job. And unfortunately, a lot of kids don't.
Remote school hurts.
And the latter are doing poorly. They're getting D's and F's.
Yeah, there are a lot of poor grades being had right now. Yeah. So we've got economic depression. We've got mental health depression. We've got educational costs for kids.
Most hourly workers are essential workers that have to go to work. So kids are being left untended, and parents can't be there to make them responsible if they don't have the ability to be responsible about school or eating or.
So we've got costs that kids endure when they are not able to be around adults other than their parents. Some of that is their ability to do well in school. Some of it is making sure that they eat well and regularly. Some of it is the ability to be noticed if they're having either physical, emotional, or abusive difficulty. And so there's a lack of access to other people that plays out in those negative health ways. John.
To me, the only standard of measurement is whether we are intentionally killing people. Ignoring the problem is killing people. I'm sorry if some kid doesn't do well in his homework, but if we are killing his mom and his grandpa, we're killing people. I mean, it's a start.
I'm hearing you there.
To me as all that. I'm not overstating. I'm not even talking politics.
Okay, let's talk about health. Let's talk about physical health. What are some physical health costs of a lockdown strategy?
Not as bad as being dead.
Depends on whether you die of them. So, John, hear me out here. I am generally with you. I am generally with you that we've got to get this rate of infection under control. If we don't manage the rate of infection, from this is where I sit, I don't see the economy coming back. I don't see education coming back. I don't see the ways that we have ordinarily gotten on in the world. I don't see them coming back without getting the infections under control. And there are real costs to lockdown. And there are physical health costs of lockdown. Because if it is generally hard to get out, or generally understood to be dangerous to get out and go, I don't know, to an appointment with your doctor, what are some things that are likely to happen?
You don't get your blood pressure checked. You don't get an A1C drawn if you're diabetic. You do telehealth visits, so they don't check all those things that they normally check. They're going to miss some health conditions. I, for the first time in 40 years, don't know what my A1C is because I've just done telehealth visits for the last 6 months.
But I did a telehealth and also I went to a lab and got my A1C and that was sent to my doctor. And then I did a telehealth.
Yeah. Or some people
so you can't the doctor some doctors are getting around, you know.
Well, it's
you
have to go. It's and I could too. I could too.
But some people are just afraid to go to the doctor because of COVID. Exactly. They just don't want to go out.
Yes. Right. And you're gonna find
I haven't gotten my haircut.
Yeah.
I need a haircut.
And you're going to find, I would bet, you will find the same partisan tendency reflected in who is afraid to go to the doctor. Now, some people are just aware enough of what their pre-existing conditions are that you can be politically conservative and know that you just ought not go to the doctor unless you really need it, right? You're generally going to find because of the way that the messaging has sorted itself nationwide on a political level, because of the way that messaging has sorted itself, you're going to find different behaviors depending on where one stands on the political spectrum. And what Rothwell and McCready are saying is that this political polarization is why we have such a poor response to coronavirus in this country. Because we are presenting this, we sort of nationwide have tended to present responses to the coronavirus as if they were an all or nothing thing. As if it was either, you know, throw off your mask and go, you know, continue with life as normal and pretend everything's fine, or wear your mask and sit at home and don't go out and do anything.
That's two extremes.
That is two extremes, isn't it? Am I wrong when I, and check me on this, am I wrong when I say that that's how we have tended to characterize the available responses here?
I think I'm in a different circle.
Good.
I do a little of both.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, why does it have to be one extreme or the other? I think the majority are trying to follow, are trying to be careful. I mean, truly, I believe in Iwegians that much. I think they are wonderful people who will try, and I just don't. And now, nationwide, I think there's still good people. I mean, there are enough who are trying, but they don't have access. Many people don't have access to news, to media, to education, to all of that, that honestly, they don't know. Just like you didn't know about three-ply masks, and you're an educated man. So I really, that's just my view. Is I don't know anybody who has died of COVID yet other than Bernie. You know, I mean, none of my friends are that way. And they're fairly all not conservative, careful.
Careful.
Common mm-hmm. sense. Yes.
Common careful. Sense.
Common sense.
Yeah. Oh. But I do know somebody.
Bruce is off of his. He just walked in and said, that's because they're all old.
It's because they're old.
But even my kids are careful. My grandkids, you know, they're forced into school and work. So things like that have to happen.
My kids are working.
Yeah. Yeah. But anyway.
So, yeah.
That's my thought.
So again, the big public health recommendations here include wear a mask, keep physical distance from each other, don't go out more than you need to, wash your hands and then wash your hands. And
happy birthday.
Yes, wash your hands sufficiently, get you 20 seconds.
I just washed my hands.
Good, now you can join us.
He's here.
And so a lot of these, you know, a lot of the sort of basic everyday precautions are very easy to do. And a lot of the, you know, a lot of the, there's a whole piece of the data that we haven't covered directly that includes who's been getting it. And the impact of who has been infected with COVID has been a picture of everything that we've talked about for the last several weeks about equity.
Yes. The minorities.
Absolutely. So the poorer you are and the browner you are, the more likely you are to either be in a situation where you have to work in person, hands on, you don't have the choice. Many of the early big outbreaks in Iowa were in meatpacking plants, which are just, it's like they're purpose built for spreading viruses from one person to another. Right. You know, right now we're having a sizable outbreak at the Anamosa State Penitentiary, which again, it's like it's purpose built for spreading virus from brown person to brown person.
There's the nursing homes.
And then there's the nursing homes, which again are
pre-existing conditions.
Pre-existing conditions and age and close quarters. And so a lot of the places that we're seeing the big, big numbers are in these settings where they are disproportionately people who are already at higher risk, either because of their pre-existing health conditions or the what they call the social determinants of health, which is terrible phrasing, but the social factors that make someone more susceptible to the poor brown, health outcomes.
Hispanics, the
yeah.
Indians, yeah.
Right.
Native Americans.
Right.
From what I can see, these things that you're mentioning are almost exclusively things that could be handled by a government that cared about its people. We seem to have enough money to throw billions in airlines, but trying to get some extra testing into a county nursing home or any of the other things you mentioned, or extend a few unemployment benefits so somebody doesn't have to go back to that packing plant, that seems to be beyond us. I have not mentioned the words Republican, Democrat, conservative, liberal, anything about that. I am still talking about this as a matter of how we should approach this as Christians. And maybe the only question I have is, what can I do about it?
So without, I think you're right. Without saying which political party ought to do this, I think you are making, I mean, you've enumerated some of the things that would be necessary in order to do this, because again, public health knows what categories of things need to happen, right? All the sort of basic personal protective things that we described, masks, distancing, hygiene, robust testing, the number for the sort of rule of thumb for whether you're testing enough to sort of manage a pandemic is, again, if you've got a test positivity rate of less than 5%, the WHO actually says, I think, about 3%. If you have more than 10%, the thing that tells you is that you don't have enough testing. It means you no longer know how many infections there are. I say that based on the public health research, not based on a political position, right? And the other thing that sort of the guideline that they say is you need to test about 1.5% of your population daily. You need to test about 1.5% of your population every day to be confident that you are staying ahead of the infections, which means we need more testing. Because we simply don't have that number of tests. So masks, distancing, hygiene, testing, contact tracing, which means once you know where a positive case is, you figure out where it's been and where it's going. And isolation for people who either are positive or are likely to be positive, which would be those folks who were exposed. If you get those four things, you can actually get the numbers back down and under control. Again, the public health, the nonpartisan public health researchers will tell you that we are beyond the rate of infection where contact tracing is meaningful. Because if you find out tomorrow that you've got COVID, you don't know where you got it. And the state can't keep up with who you've seen. And really, the state can't keep up with who you've seen because they need to make a couple dozen phone calls for every case that comes back. And Polk County had 4,000 positive cases in the last 14 days, which, help me out, that's 80,000 phone calls someone needs to make and get answered and have a conversation with the person on the other end and find out who they've had contact with and get them to go get tested and all of that. So it's simply out of hand in order to be able to then isolate the people who need to be isolated so we can stop the thing. Again,
some of the people who have developed the COVID could do some calling and say, you've been exposed.
Our plan at Covenant during the time when we had Covenant kids in the building, the thing that we have also asked both of the 12-step groups who meet at our building to do is to record everybody who's been there, notify us immediately if you find out that you have been exposed in the 14 days before, And then we will call everybody and say, please go get a test. We haven't had to make those calls yet. I don't know if that's because we've got some groups that got lucky or because we just haven't been notified if someone had an exposure. But we've tried to really push that message out to the groups that that have gathered with us.
Good for you.
Because
taking responsibility.
Yeah, because there's not enough, you know, nobody else is positioned to do that contact tracing. you know, ordinarily the State Department of Public Health would do it. That's built into to the pandemic response plans, and the State Department of Public Health does not have the staffing and has not at any point had the staffing to do that. Even at the scale that the pandemic was in Iowa in the summer. Remember the summer?
When?
No.
So the flip side of that, of, you know, we need these four things. We've got to be able to do those four things in order to actually get the pandemic under control is to make some really prudent decisions about, you know, what kinds of economic activity are appropriately sort of safe enough to have and necessary to have, and how do we protect the people in those jobs? How do we look at economic activity that's not really safe enough to have? Nobody at any credible level of the public health world thinks that we ought to have restaurants and bars open for dine-in use right now. Every week, the White House tells the governor to close the bars and restaurants. That is part of the CDC's response package based on how, you know, on what the infection rates are. So as of, this is the October 25th report I'm looking at right here. The mitigation efforts have to include physical distancing, keeping people apart, and shutting down those public venues where people gather and take their masks off, right? Because most of us can't eat with a mask on.
Right.
You know, and unless your margarita is frozen, you can't drink that with a mask on. So again, this is the White House telling the governor's office, here's the package of responses that we need in order to cut out some of the really risky economic settings. Word is that Europe is reopening schools relatively successfully. I'm not convinced that Iowa is reopening schools relatively successfully, but we've got very different background case rates. So I'm not sure that the comparison is quite apt, but I have been angry. I'm just going to say that I have been angry at the idea that we have to reopen schools for in-person learning, and we are not going to close the bars to do it. Because if we're going to say that in-person education is a necessary social good, but we are not willing to, as a state, pick up the cost of making that safe, I am angry about that. Which again is a matter of priorities. I think it is problematic to say we have to shut everything down. We may need to right now, because this thing is burning through like wildfire right now. And when the wildfire is out of control, you have to hunker down and do something. So I'm not a public health expert, I don't know. But to be selective about how we reintroduce some of those activities so that we're actually benefiting people. John asks if President-elect Biden is doing it right in his approach to appeal to our better angels. Is that enough? I have not looked at Biden's COVID response plan. So I cannot tell you whether his approach is right or wrong. When you say appeal to our better angels, that sounds a lot like Governor Reynolds' COVID response plan, which has not worked.
Impossible to get everybody on board. They got too many people who are saying it's their rights to die or be stupid. There's too many people that are deaf and dumb. It's impossible to get everybody on board.
So we need to, as a society, make the decision that we're going to respond in a meaningful and, you know, and research-based way, which
the action you're saying.
Yeah, what actions will we take? And will we take those actions in a research-based way? Again, I want to be really, really clear that there are direct and often avoidable costs to a lockdown approach. That if we can't figure out a way to get people into their doctors, then we are, it may be better than nothing, right? What were the three approaches in our video, right? There's the race through until we get herd immunity, which herd immunity is a much more complicated goal than we think. But you know, race through, get everybody sick, and some of them get better. That has huge costs. Delay forever until we have a vaccine. By the way, a vaccine is going to take probably 12 to 18 months to manufacture and distribute to the scale that we need in order to achieve herd immunity. So the vaccine is going to be a slow answer itself, even if Pfizer's positive results that were just released, I believe this morning, right? Even if those continue to pan out and, you know, conceivably we have a vaccine for emergency use by the end of the year. I don't know. But even then, it's going to take a very long time, and it will be a political question to get the vaccine out to everybody, because we're going to have to prioritize. And when we prioritize, that is by definition a political question, because any decision that affects more than one person is a political question. So John wanted to say something after I said that appealing to our better angels is what Governor Reynolds had asked us to do. Then he disappeared and came back.
Well, that was Bruce. He's doing magic again. But I keep saying President Biden. President-to-be Biden is saying every day in every speech is, Americans, please wake up, get smart, and quit hurting each other. Follow the CDC guidelines. If we wear masks, it's going to save thousands and thousands and thousands of lives. I'm not trying to make anybody do anything yet, but this is something you can do for yourselves and mostly for each other. That's the point he's been making again and again.
Okay, so on that count, then, his messaging matches Governor Reynolds' messaging over the past few months.
I don't
only
follow.
Because he doesn't have the ability to do anything more than that right now.
Right.
There will be a whole plan in front of us.
Right. So, but in answer to John's question about is appealing to our better angels enough?
No, it isn't.
No. And I
got rules. Give us a rule.
And so there is a place. And this I don't think needs to be a partisan political thing either. I think there would be a way to do this that is not the same as whatever President-elect Biden's plan is. But there is a place for a coordinated social response that really the only people who can coordinate a social response at that level is the government. Whether it's the federal government or the state government is a different question. You can play out the politics of it in all sorts of different ways, right? But what we don't have and what we have not had in Iowa is a coordinated approach to basic things like mask wearing, or an evidence-based approach to things like where and how should people be allowed to serve food and drinks.
I guess I've been in the radical end of things too long, but I note that the only way we got some measure of social justice, black equality is what I'm talking about, is because not the government, but the people, and particularly the religious people, got up and said, enough. Now, I'm not sure that you, Nathan, or any other batch of clergy in Des Moines could accomplish that tomorrow morning. But that is an approach that I am suggesting, that we have people who think like I think you do, get up and say enough, as opposed to what Kimmy is saying, which is, oh, please, please make this go away. Please don't make me do anything to anybody, because that'll make me less unpopular, less popular politically. Yeah, that's strident.
So I'm gonna allow that stridency to be there, because I've acknowledged that for me, this is also an emotional issue. Because it seems that there's something we could be doing and we don't seem to be doing it. Why haven't we been doing it is, again, a lot of it is the way that we are politically polarized. I almost showed you a different video that would have come at this from a different angle, to not actually talk about coronavirus, but just to talk about why we make decisions that are sort of cheating on our own ethics. And one of the reasons, so, you know, this is some fun little behavioral psychology research, if you give people a chance to cheat on a math test or something, one of the things that changes how they cheat on a math test is whether they see other people in their group cheating on the math test and getting away with it. And if they see somebody in their opposite group, so, you know, you play this scenario with college students and you have somebody wearing the arch rival's football sweatshirt, and they make a big show of cheating and getting away with it, everybody else's behavior gets better, because we tend to define ourselves against some other group. So there are pieces of this that are, our brains are sort of captive to the, captive to how we identify ourselves. Are we us or are they them? And that has spun the way that we react. In addition to which, as we started with, we're really bad at making decisions. We're really bad at making safety decisions that affect other people. And so that, I think, is where some kind of coordinated evidence-based response needs to happen. And you could do that at a federal level or a state level or a local level. What we have is a really sort of strange amalgam of those, because the federal level doesn't agree with itself and the state level won't let the local level make those decisions. the religious side, I had to cancel Christmas this year. We're making plans for a virtual Christmas Eve service. To be honest with you, I've seen that coming since the end of the summer at least, because the numbers had never gotten better. And where they are right now, I would never in a million years. I won't do it. And I am heartbroken to know at the beginning of November that there is just no realistically safe path to having any, even a small group in together for Christmas at this point.
You mean no Santa Claus and Mrs. Claus?
No.
Can they be virtual?
You could be virtual.
It's hard to sit them on our laps.
It is, yeah.
Such little dollies.
Yeah, Warren.
Before this wraps up, I just have had something here I just got to get said.
Yeah, you bet.
I'm a bean counter, a number cruncher with some economics. We have something right now that's impacting everybody in the U.S. and almost everybody in the world. The one thing that concerns me, there's another item that will impact everybody in this United States. It's called unlimited borrowing. There's 536 people, counting the president, the Senate, and the House. Out of 330 million in the whole US, those 536 people can borrow unlimited money. We have no balanced budget amendment. Let me give you an example. It took over 200 years to accumulate $5 trillion of national debt. 200 years. In less than 15, we now are at 25 plus trillion with a T. And one piece of legislation that is passed in 2020, I think was $2 trillion. Now remember, it took us 200 years to get to $5 trillion total national debt. And in one piece of legislation, 536 people who have control said, yeah, to the tune of, why don't we put an additional $600 a week, not a month, but $600 a week on top of the unemployment comp? Now, I agree that there's people that need assistance. $600 in addition to your unemployment? They have never had it so good. But what I'm getting at is there's 536 people that can decide that. Maybe they're going to give them 1,000 a week in this next bill, which will probably come up. Both Republican, Democrat, liberal, independents. You look at a pie chart every year, and I'll predict in our lifetimes, the little wedge for interest on the national debt will expand so rapidly, it will probably overtake major items like national defense. But you cannot just trust 536 people. They're hurting out there. We're going to borrow. They don't have the money, especially with the economy going down. There's no way in hell they've got the money. They're borrowing it. $26 trillion, $30 trillion. Interest rates are low. But as interest rates go up, what we pay on the national debt will go up accordingly. All of a sudden, that little sliver in the pie chart for interest, quarter of the budget. So I'm just saying that whoever's in there, I don't know what happens to them when they get in Washington, Republican, Democrat alike. They will sign off on a $2 trillion, $3 trillion, like you and I would sign up for some petty cash. There's the real item when this is all said and done. Look at where that national debt is. That's not going away. And they say, oh, well, we owe it to ourselves. If one more person tells me that, don't worry about the national debt because we just owe it to ourselves. No, no, whoever owns those bonds and T-bills and all, they kind of expect that interest. And there are a lot of them are not Americans, as in our friends, the Chinese. The Chinese would do us all a favor if they said, you know what? I don't think I want to buy any more American debt. That's the only way you're going to shut this down is if you can't find anybody that will loan you money. I just had to get that said. And one more thing, and then I will wrap up. And I think it was John commented on it. How many of these mom and pop businesses are going to go out of business and never come back? It's kind of like eminent domain. Mm-hmm. I'd say the federal government, due to the federal government actions, these restaurants and bars will go out of business. And I'm going to say to Andy Hoffman, I'm going to deny you your business. And I'm also going to compensate it because I know this government action will shut you down. Yeah, it's going to be a lot of money, but what's a lot of money? You ever priced an aircraft carrier lately? Or we got so many things. I think you've got to look at the impact of the businesses that will definitely go out due to government action and pay that business owner just like eminent domain. Thank you.
Warren, I would love to see us pay the hospitality industry to stay shut down for a while. I would love to see us do it. Now, the question that you asked, or you know, the issue that you raised about structural budget deficit. Man, I have already kept you much longer than the time that you owe me from the beginning of class. But part of any sensible response strategy, in my book anyway, has got to be exactly making it economically viable for the parts of the economy that can't safely reopen to stay shut down. Yeah. And however you do that, whether whether you do it as a buyout or you do it as a conditional stimulus or how you do that, but
why should that one sliver of the economy who you know will probably be wiped out pay the burden when a lot of folks, myself included, have not really had too much of a financial impact from this?
Right.
And I'm just Bruce, I'm just using Andy Hoffman to kind of personalize this. Andy Hoffman is a son of a former Covenant member. And like I say, anybody that's ever owned a business, you generally have to scrape to get enough down payment to finance your first business. And if it fails, sorry, I probably don't have enough personal assets to have a second go round. I'm done. I become Warren Pitcher, employee of somebody else. And I think we owe it to them. The small business owners, they shouldn't take the brunt of the financial hit. Like, say, I'm just saying, I haven't had much of an impact. But I'm also worried when the Social Security check bounces. The first time one of my Social Security check bounces, I don't think I'll live that long. But when you put this new administration in, Republican and Democrat, if they keep borrow, remember wheelbarrows of German marks to buy a loaf of bread? Oh, that won't happen here. It won't happen in Venezuela. No, it won't happen here. Stay tuned. Thank you.
You bet. All right, y'all. We are going to need to leave it there with the knowledge that this is a very complicated set of decisions and that we are not... we're not going to be able to simply flip a switch and make this thing go away. But this exactly, attending to we have to take this seriously and we have to take seriously the costs of taking this seriously. I never thought I would say it, but pray for Pfizer, right?
Yeah, they'll do well.
They're going to do great, aren't they?
Buy Pfizer stock.
Yeah. Lauren, I've got thoughts on how to keep Social Security solvent and how to give everybody enough money every month. And both of them have to do with Pfizer, as it happens.
What a tease for another meeting.
Isn't it?
Thank you for listening. Learn more about our mission at wdmcovenant.org.